long shot at this point, I think, for Biagi.
So you co-authored this piece, Alex. New York Times faces backlash over Dan Goldman endorsement debacle. New York Times endorsing three white men in a very diverse primary race. Sean Patrick Maloney and Jerry Nadler and Dan Goldman. Can you talk about Dan Goldman and the person right up against him, Mondaire Jones, the significance of Eileen New as well, the significance of the Times not revealing the close ties of the publisher to the Goldman family?
Yeah, absolutely. There are a lot of irregularities, actually, in this endorsement. And in the header, if you read the endorsement, it says that these three races could decide whether Democrats or Republicans hold the House starting next year. And that's just not true. All three races are safe Democratic races, and there's really no way the Republicans are going to win any of those three seats. So it kind of steps off on this kind of, this just inaccurate description of the political climate in New York and these elections. And the race in particular in 10 is fascinating because, right, the endorsement, if you read it, speaks glowingly of Mondaire Jones. If you read it without knowing who they were going to endorse, you would assume at the very least that Jones would be receiving a co-endorsement. But it ends up, endorsing Goldman. And of the six candidates that I mentioned, Goldman's the only one who isn't and hasn't held elected office. He's the white man in the race. This is a majority minority district. It's New York City's most diverse. And they don't even mention two of the four, of the front runners, even of that six, Eileen New and Carolina Rivera don't even get mentioned in the text of the endorsement. So those things are, very peculiar. And then to add on top of that, the fact that the publisher didn't disclose his close ties to the Sulzberger family and the Goldman family have ties going back decades, that's not disclosed. He didn't recuse himself from the endorsement process. And the fact that the Times editorial board ultimately, in the statement that we were given, said that, the editorial board answers to the publisher.
We have to leave it there. Alex Salmon, I want to thank you so much for being with us. We'll link to your coverage at the American Prospect. Very happy birthday to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Listen, no, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. You don't know.
Hey, Michael here. I'm with the Tin Can Phone Podcast, a radio show where you can hear about the influence incarceration has straight from the source. We tell you the story from the inside out. So make sure to check us out on KBOO Community Radio every first Tuesday at 10 a.m.
Every single person since SB8 has been a law has needed to travel out of state. Every single person that's reached our line.
We've been clinging on to Roe versus Wade and the protection that it offered. And it feels as though that protection is being taken away from us. So it feels as though this is a moment of survival. And I think any moments of survival can be very scary.
What did abortion access look like in America when Roe was the law of the land? Tune into KBOO's Roe on the Rocks, a limited series podcast where I investigate this question as I take you through the months leading up to the U.S. Supreme Court decision that effectively overturned Roe. That's Roe on the Rocks, airing Thursdays at 9 a.m. You don't want to miss it.
This is KBOO Portland. It's just after 8 a.m. on a Tuesday morning. It's time for Too Much Information with your hosts, Tracy Simmons and Abe Proctor. Stay tuned.
Hey, good morning. Good morning and welcome to Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7 FM. My name is Abe Proctor and joining me as she does each and every week, the inestimable Tracy Simmons. Tracy, good morning. And how has almost all of the summer gone by already? So two questions for you right off the bat.
Good morning, Abe. Good morning, listeners. I was thinking the exact same thing, like, oh my goodness, like, what happened? It didn't start early, and it seems like it's ending early. So here we are, right? Here we are. But one thing I just noticed and was watching the news last night, and they said that the air quality for August in Oregon has been just about the best that we can expect with regard to fires burning in the state. Of course, we are going to talk about the Climate Act today and inflation reduction, but it seems like it's holding off, and hopefully it holds off through September as well. But we've got a pretty clear sky for August. And just to remember this time a couple years back, it was real smoky in August and September. And September of, 2020 was one of the worst on records. I mean, literally people were locked into their houses. So we're not there. It is the dog days of summer, and the kids are going back to school. So hopefully folks are planning for some good times before it all comes to a halt.
Yeah. In recognition of that time-honored scientific tradition, the jinx, I am now touching every piece of wood I can reach, because you're right. The air has been blessedly clear this summer, and let's hope we can make it through the rest without significant air quality problems, not to mention significant habitat loss and carbon liberation associated with wildfires. So far, so good this year. So as Tracy mentioned, we are going to do something we've been talking about for a few weeks now on this program, and that is to get into some of the meat of the recently passed Inflation Reduction Act, which, despite its flaws, is a significant step forward in terms of climate investment in this country. And while it doesn't get us to where we need to go, it is an important step along that path, and it's something we can build on for future legislation. So we're going to talk a little bit more about what's inside that act. But before we do, I believe, Tracy, you have an update for us from the sunny climes of South Florida. What do you got?
Yes. So, you know, last week we talked a little bit, delved into the story that continues to develop with Trump. And it seems that, you know, I shared the recovery, but it looks like Trump had more than 300 classified documents, as reported by the New York Times yesterday. And over 150 sensitive papers were found in a batch, and helping to explain the urgent response and the raid. Of course, at this point, Trump is trying to get those documents back, asserting that they are his documents. He wants the FBI to stop looking at those documents and has asked to appoint a special master to track down the classified documents and return them to him. I mean, we are talking the levels of espionage and national security threat that has never been experienced by this country on the part of a former president. And we should all be very, very nervous about what he has, who he's, you know, sharing that material with, who he's already shared the material with, and where else he squirreled away some of these documents. So watch the space. We'll continue giving you updates about that. But this is, you know, once again, information that is at the highest levels of national security, sensitive, compartmented information, which typically cannot be viewed by certain people, cannot be viewed outside of certain spaces, and cannot even be described to us because they're that sensitive. So once again, we have an ongoing story that we'll continue to update you on. Watch the space.
There's a lot of interesting wrinkles in the story as it develops. The New York Times, I think it's probably the piece that you've been referencing, calls to mind the fact that earlier in the year, when the former president returned to the National Archives the first tranche of documents that he had illegally absconded with, the reporting in the Times indicates that Trump himself went through the boxes of documents and decided which ones he was going to immediately hand over to the archives and which ones he didn't. So that's here. Sorry, I'm laughing because sometimes it's just so stupid. You have to laugh at the stupid because it's so stupid. So he actually did this himself. He actually put his hands on the documents and he sorted them, he collated them himself. So he won't even be able to offer the excuse of hiding behind the actions of an inept underling. He did it himself. And moreover, the legal brief that was submitted on his behalf claiming that these documents are in fact his appears to be largely written by the man himself, because I read excerpts of this thing and there are sections where they use the pronoun these are my documents. So it appears that either he's operating with no legal representation at all, or the most indifferent legal representation that money can buy. And if this is in fact the case, Tracy, it means that nobody is willing to get near this guy. Even the sleaziest lawyers you could possibly imagine are not willing to get near enough this guy because he's so tainted. Or he believes that he's so fabulous that he can simply represent himself in what promises to be an incredibly complex legal proceeding. He can just do it all on his own.
I hope it's the latter. And I know it's, you know, of course, the former is true as well, right? You think about his best friend, you know, Rudy Caluti, who is facing charges right now, is the target of an investigation. He can't step in as the lawyer. He's, totally disrespected pretty much anybody that's ever been on a legal team. And I think, you know, any lawyer worth their salt knows that anything that Donald Trump touches is toxic and harmful to their career. So anyone with any, you know, sense of I want to have a career after, you know, getting involved in this would not want to be anything involved with Donald Trump. And so the former guy, you know, is literally being hung out to dry because nobody wants to touch him. He's not paid former lawyers. Of course, many of his former lawyers are currently being investigated. Of course, many of his former lawyers no longer have the ability to practice law. So I would just say, you know, it wouldn't be surprising at all if, you know, nobody wanted to represent this person. And I think it was reported by the Washington Post a couple weeks ago that as soon as he was raided, he was searching for a really strong defense attorney team, and it was Curtis. So I just don't know that that has changed. And of course, because of how toxic this person is, you know, there's not enough money in the world for a high quality lawyer to take this client.
You know, in fairness, who among us hasn't been there before, right? Who among us hasn't been in such dire legal jeopardy that our only course of action is to seek election once again to the presidency when we'll be beyond the reach of the law? Who hasn't been there, Tracy?
It's actually ridiculous. And you just think about the people who are still supporting this man. You know, there have been protesters showing up to Mar-a-Lago, you know, to support their dear leader. And once again, right, it's like, what? This person is still free. And, you know, we talked about Reality Winner last week. One document, 5 years. The law works very swiftly for other people. And, you know, once again, we have this person who there's a long track record of behavior that continues to be a free person in the world and likely is doing more harm that we don't know of. Thankfully, I'm very sure he's under very tight surveillance at this point and being watched like a hawk by the FBI, by the CIA, and other national security agencies. So we will once again continue to see and report back to you as things develop.
Yes, fascinating and amusing. This should be a fun one to watch unfold. All right. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Very interested to hear your feedback today. We've talked a little bit about this, the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022, which I guess we can now call by its proper and full name, the Inflation Reduction Act, as it's been signed into law and is no longer a bill. We've talked a little bit in large strokes about what it does. We've also argued a little bit about what it doesn't do. So we're going to dig into those details a little bit more. With under the assumption that despite its flaws, this is a piece of legislation that progressives can get behind. This is an important step towards taking the sorts of large-scale actions that we need to take on a national level and on a local level, as we'll get into in just a moment, that we need to take to address climate change. Does it get us where we need to go? No, it does not. Does it do everything that we need it to do? No, it does not. Does it include some saps thrown to the fossil fuel industry in order to get certain senators on board to vote for it? Yes, it absolutely does. But does the good that this bill will do, does it outweigh its flaws? Yes, it absolutely does. And that's just not me talking. That's also the opinion of leading climate activists all over the place. And we'll get into some of their commentary as well. Okay, so in broad strokes, here's some of the stuff we've addressed before. There's significant investments in the law for the production of clean energy and for the acquisition of electric vehicles on the part of private vehicle owners. That's a very important component. We'll talk about that some more. It also takes the most significant legislative action yet on the emission of methane, which is a particularly problematic greenhouse gas. It has significant components involving reduction of pollution in communities of color and environmental justice causes overall, and we'll get into that in much more detail in just a minute. It also takes great strides towards regulating pollution of the industrial sector, which is right now the United States' third most polluting sector after transportation and power generation. So this bill, this law, is hitting all the right points when viewed from a high altitude. It's also incentives for the manufacturing of clean energy domestically. And it also creates new parameters for the invocation of the Defense Authorization Act, which allows the executive branch to invoke emergency production clauses in times of national emergency. These are the same clauses that successive presidents have failed to enact, Tracy, in the face of a global pandemic. Why we're all not drowning in K95 and N95 masks and drowning in cheap at-home COVID test kits right now is a result of the fact that this power was not invoked by each of the last two presidents. So this gives the executive branch this sort of power. But one of the things, Tracy and listeners, that I want to talk about today, I think they're pretty important in terms of people with a progressive worldview. And the first of these things is that the act includes a $3 billion investment for highway removal and community cleanup. This is huge. Those of you who have grown up in Portland or spent any amount of time here have probably heard some stories about the impact the construction of the I-5 freeway made in the communities of North Portland. Essentially, the I-5 freeway was constructed straight through the heart of Portland's historically black neighborhoods on its way to the Columbia River and on into Washington State. This was a huge problem. Thousands of families were displaced. Many people who were homeowners before then were not homeowners after. And when combined with a similar situation that arose for the construction of the Legacy Emmanuel Medical Complex, we have yet another chapter in a legacy of displacement and environmental injustice for the communities of color in North Portland. So this bill is going to invest in removing highways from communities like North Portland. I don't know if that stretch of I-5 is slated for removal under the bill. I think time will tell on that front. But this is a problem that repeats itself all over the country. And this bill is going to help remove those stretches of highway when possible or mitigate their effects when possible. And that's a pretty big deal, Tracy, don't you think?
It's a huge deal. And yes, it's not just you know, Portland. It's across the nation as the highways were built. Just think about that, you know, infrastructure project and when it was happening. It was happening, you know, prior to and at the height of the civil rights movement. And so there was a concerted effort to, slight communities, black communities in different areas across the country through these highway projects. And so, you know, just thinking about even Portland, what's interesting in Portland, there's been conversations for a while about expanding the I-5 freeway, which would further harm, you know, the black community who still exists in North Portland, although many of those families have been displaced already and the place has been gentrified. We will see what, if any, impact it has on Portland, but definitely even thinking about where, you know, I-5 goes through in different places in California and in different places in Washington. It's just interesting how they really cut through and bisected many of the communities, inner city communities, that were, of course, through practices of redlining, practices of, you know, real estate malpractice, you know, concentrating black communities. And so we will see. There's hope there. I can continue to be cautiously optimistic, of course.
Just to give people an idea of the scope of this problem, it's estimated that the Federal Aid Highway Act of 1956 alone, this was the act that paved the way, pardon the phrasing, for the interstate highway system. It's estimated that that legislation alone displaced more than 1 million people. That's incredible. Imagine an event right now that displaced 1 million people in American life. It's incredible. And by and large, these displacements happened in and among communities who could not afford to defend themselves against this action. And this is going to go a long way to address the problems that are endemic amongst communities who live in close proximity to large highways, the particulate matter that they breathe in and out every day, and the respiratory problems that accompany them. This is a huge step towards mitigating that problem. So this $3 billion that have been marked for neighborhood access and equity grants, in addition to the highway relocation money, stacks with the $1 billion that was already appropriated for this same purpose under the bipartisan infrastructure law that was passed last fall. So that's $4 billion that can be invested in local communities around the country to do a whole lot of things like improving walkability in neighborhoods, capping old wells, installing noise barriers, and moving to mitigate the urban heat island effect, which leads to higher sustained temperatures during hot parts of the year in poor communities and communities of color. So this is a big deal. And I'm really pleased to see this because it reflects a priority that has been there amongst the progressive caucuses in the House and the Senate for a while. This was reflected in the Green New Deal legislation, which was passed by the House during the former presidency. And also most of what was in the Build Back Better legislation, which resembled almost entirely the Green New Deal. The difference being primarily that President Biden felt politically he couldn't afford to utter the words Green New Deal. So we called it something different. But that Build Back Better legislation and the Green New Deal were incredibly cognizant of the environmental injustices done over the years by these large-scale transportation projects. And the need to make a comprehensive attempt to address climate change, also an attempt to mitigate past social and economic injustices. The realization that these projects are of a piece, Tracy, is incredibly important to understand philosophically as we move forward with this great work. And that may sound grandiose, but this is the great work of our generation and probably a few more generations to come. So unless we embark on this work with a consciousness of removing harm from communities who have been harmed in the past and preventing that same sort of harm going forward, we have to have that in mind. So it's really good to see that this is in the legislation.
I think, too, you know, when I'm looking at this bill and the potential impacts, If you remember, just a couple months ago, the Supreme Court restricted the ability of the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, to fight climate change. And basically, they, you know, took away the agency's authority around burning fossil fuels. And through this new bill, through this new climate law, language is written specifically in there to address the Supreme Court and to reinstate the ability and the authority to regulate greenhouse gases. So, of course, you've got this, you know, very extreme, very much slanted towards corporate interests, you know, oil and gas interests in the Supreme Court. And basically this law has codified the ability for the EPA to do the job of you know, protecting the environment by managing and being able to have oversight over the greenhouse gas emissions. So restored some of the ability for the EPA to do what it was here for.
Yeah, I'm really glad you mentioned that. That's incredibly important. We all know about the Supreme Court decision recently. It said, no, executive branch, you don't have the authority to regulate industrial emissions because Congress didn't give you that power. Well, now Congress has given the EPA that power. So it was a nice, neat response to that very, very silly Supreme Court ruling. Now, that's something we should mention in the context of discussion this legislation is that there's probably going to be some stupid Supreme Court rulings in our future, Tracy, that we're going to have to navigate. But this was a very neat way to address at least one of them.
Mm-hmm. I think, too, and, you know, I'm always thinking about, you know, kind of long term. The idea of the impact of this act is that it will reduce those greenhouse gas emissions by a gigaton. I don't even know how to express a gigaton with my big brain because I don't know what that even means. But it sounds like a lot. And it puts America on track to cut climate pollution by 40% or to cut the pollution that we currently have in half by 2030. That is something to be, you know, pleased by. I'm always, of course, thinking about who was signing on to this, right? Wondering who was opposing. Of course, we know who was opposing the oil and gas industry. You know, some of the big polluters, of course. And of course, there is a piece of this bill that's around inflation costs for medicine, and Big Pharma was definitely, you know, doing all they could to make sure that this act did not pass. So there's always the air of suspicion. But, you know, I think we should be excited. A gigaton, I just looked it up, is 1 billion metric tons of greenhouse gases that will be reduced. That's huge. And once again, right, this is the start. This is the first climate act that has been passed in, what, 40 years. It's a start. And as we see positive impacts, we likely will continue to see other policymakers step forward with other good ideas to continue this trend, to protect our environment, to allow us to live on this earth a little bit longer.
Yes. Now, what I'm interested to hear from our listeners is that I understand that there's a good many progressives out there who are at the very least skeptical about this legislation. And in fact, critical of it, and some have even rejected it on the grounds that it doesn't do everything we need to do to mitigate climate change. It doesn't do everything we need to do to undo the damage of 150 years plus of industrial society. And it doesn't punish bigwig polluters enough. And all of that is true. But I want to return to a maxim that we've tried to make very clear, not being too gentle. We've really tried to hammer it home time and again on this program. That in this day and age, with all the flaws and the paralysis inherent in our political system, with all the outsized influence that big money is able to wield over that political system, that we as progressives have to seize victories when they come along and grab them with both hands. We can't afford any longer to sit back and reject things like this on the grounds that they simply don't do enough. We can acknowledge that they don't do enough. We have to grab them with both hands, and we have to hang on, because this is how the conversation changes over time. This is how the paradigm shifts such that war becomes possible. It is by taking victories like this. It is by taking concrete steps towards climate change mitigation, that making measurable progress that we can point to later and use as the grounds for, as the justification for even more sweeping legislation in the future. This is why we have to take these victories now. This is why we have to take this to the bank, because it's how we create the landscape to make even more progress in the future. This is how we get where we need to be, progressives. Warts and all, this is how we get where we need to be. So as much as it may stick in your craw, and believe me, it does in mine from time to time, you got to take the wins when they come along. And any way you look at it, this is a win, despite the giveaways to the fossil fuel industry, despite the giveaways to wealthy investment bankers. This is a win. Any comment, Tracy, before we dig back in here?
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm with you. I am that progressive that's always like, who's really going to win from this, right? And I think we should all be looking, you know, reading between the lines and trying to figure out what is also the impact to my community, what's the impact to me as a human, and be making decisions about that. And at the same time, right, yes, we have to be thinking, the name progressive means we have to progress. We've got to move forward some things. And I think when we get to the point where we're fighting over, you know, what it is we're winning, nothing happens, right? And so you get that blockade, you get that stagnant energy that doesn't move us anywhere near where we need to be. You know, thinking about even, you know, just what is the average American going to experience from this, right? There's a continued ability to have some reduction in costs for health insurance. Health insurance is one of the most expensive things, of course, and it continues to get more expensive every year. So there will be about $800 yearly savings on your health insurance premiums, potentially saving $100 yearly on just regular bills. Of course, also eligible for, if you were eligible for the American Rescue Plan tax credits, healthcare tax credits, you will likely also be able to continue those tax credits that could save you thousands of dollars on your healthcare. And if, you know, some, you know, people lost protection with the ACA, when those tax credits expire, you'll be able to keep the coverage from the ACA and get the tax credits through other means, right? So you get healthcare tax credits if your you know, total bill that you pay in your healthcare reach a certain amount, you can get a percentage of that back in a tax credit, and that will continue as well. So right, there might be some relief for individuals within the healthcare sector that are critical. America is one of the least healthy countries because, you know, we have, you know, mostly monetized healthcare and not seen it as a human right. This is also, as we get closer to making these adjustments, we can move closer to, you know, potentially national health care, you know, Medicare for all, Medicaid for all. I think that I'm not a fan of incrementalism, yet we have to take steps forward to get to where we eventually want to be. And, of course, we have to continue voting, and we have to continue demanding of the policymakers that they consider what we need as humans, as opposed to continue, you know, getting money hand over fist from the people who would like to continue monetizing our health.
Well said. All right. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Engineer Sonia has weighed in on a couple points. First, she points out that 2.2 trillion pounds is your gigaton. That's a lot of pounds. She also points out that this bill is a, or this law is a win for fossil fuels and investment bankers. I think you could argue that in the short term, it is a win for those people, probably more so for the investment bankers than for the fossil fuel industry. Yes, this bill includes the opening up of more real estate for offshore drilling in the United States. It also, as a bone thrown to Joe Manchin, authorizes a pipeline to carry natural gas through West Virginia to Virginia. But the carbon removal, the carbon sequestration, the caps on emissions, the reduction in methane, all of these things over the long term vastly outweigh these bones thrown to the fossil fuel industry in the short term. And again, this is not just me talking. There's all kinds of analysis to back this up. As far as investment bankers go, yes, Kyrsten Sinema, the senator from Goldman Sachs, insisted on preserving the carried interest loophole as the cost of passing this bill. The carried interest loophole is a clause that allows investment bankers to have their money taxed at a much lower rate than it would be otherwise. Yes, it's an important thing that in terms of economic and social justice, we absolutely have to come to grips with in this country. This bill didn't do it. But again, it's not a justification to throw the baby out with the bathwater here. So 503-231-8187. Let's go to Corey. Good morning, Corey.
Hey, good morning, guys. I'll be pretty brief. Someone asked on Twitter, like, well, are you progressives happy with Joe Biden? And my answer was yes. And I'm not with Joe Biden, my first choice. No, he wasn't even my second choice. Do I think he should run again? No. But right now, if it's between, you know, my choices are Joe Biden or what we could have had on the other side. And I think the reason why this legislation passed is because on the other side, it's just an automatic no. I mean, the fact that, you know, it went to 50-50, then we have Vice President Harris. But am I happy right now that Joe Biden is president? Yes. Like I said, I think, and you're exactly right, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Progressives need to realize that this is maybe just the first step. But yeah, and I don't also see Joe Biden as a god. I see him as a vehicle to get things done. Where on the other side, they're worshiping this man who I still don't understand it. I think there's a lot of mental brainwashing that is in the water now. I think it's either you're down with that man or not. It's hard to break away when you've been brainwashed by someone who is so imperfect. But no, I think the legislation that was passed, especially when it comes to things such as the environment, especially someone like me who's really into research and environmental racism, I think it's amazing. And I think that's all due to the Biden administration. I don't think that anyone else could have done this. And once again, I'm not the biggest Joe Biden fan, but like I said, compared to what else we could have had in the office another 4 years of Trump, I'm happy with what he's doing right now. And I kind of leave it at that. Thank you, guys.
And thanks for the call.
Thanks, Corey.
Your thoughts, Tracy?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a fan either. And also, right, he's had some big wins, and he's done more in 2 years than the former guy did in four. And of course, we don't even know about all the harm the former guy did. So he's passed this Inflation Reduction Act, the CHIPS Act, the CHIPS and Science, that's to manufacture the chips that are causing a backlog of auto manufacturers and other electronics manufacturers to get out products. So CHIPS and Science Act, the PACT Act, the bipartisan gun law, the gas prices right now are plummeting. There's huge jobs numbers, and they've been huge, historically low unemployment, the confirmation of the first black justice on the Supreme Court, definitely the American Rescue Plan, the bipartisan infrastructure law, and working right now with Senate to negotiate an update to the Electoral Count Act. So, you know, I'm not a big fan, right? I'm still wondering, you know, can Joe Biden pronounced the word abortion. I'm still, you know, worried about my rights, the rights of queer people, the rights of black people, that I'm hearing very little from Joe Biden on. We talked a few weeks back about, you know, this idea of, you know, funding the cops. Like, there's some real problems here, but, you know, we have to take the bad with the good.
That can be hard to swallow. Yeah, that's true, but it's absolutely the case. Yeah, and this is, you know, it is what it is. Legislation is, the process is big, it's messy, and especially for progressives, we never get everything we want. The thing is, historically, we rarely have gotten anything that we want. So when something like this comes along, like this, yeah, you know, I think it's a good idea to pause and acknowledge, yes, this is a win. Okay, 503-231-8187. I want to get back into some of the perhaps lesser known components of this bill that I think really helped to make it a good thing. We talked about the need to transition away from fossil fuels as a source of energy. We also talked about the fact that this legislation has a few bones that are thrown to the fossil fuel industry. It also has, Tracy, direct payment to rural electric co-ops in this country. Now, why is that important? Well, most of the electricity provided to rural communities in this country, not all of it, but most of it, is provided through organizations called rural electric co-ops. Now, these are not big investor-owned utilities, so they often lack the capital necessary to make large-scale infrastructure changes. And that's one of the reasons that rural electric co-ops have a higher proportion of their power generated by coal plants than other electric grids in the country. So giving rural electric co-ops the resources they need to modernize and wean themselves off coal-generated power is an absolutely critical component of transitioning the entire nationwide power grid off of fossil fuels. So this provision is going to help the country retire its last 172 coal plants within a decade. That is enormous. Within a decade, no more coal-burning power plants. It's really hard for me to overstate how important that is to this entire process. So that's another reason that this this bill is a good thing for progressives. Also, it also provides for large block grants in the billions of dollars to individual states to allow them to enact emissions initiatives of their own accord. So this is a chance for different states to try out different ideas to see how well they work. And it doesn't have to be the governor or the state legislature of a given state that applies for these states. These grants are going to be administered by the EPA, and organizations and individuals of all stripes are going to be able to submit proposals to try and win some of these grants. This is going to help blue states to move towards their goals to move entirely away from fossil fuel generated power. It's going to help red states, which have historically suffered from poor maintenance of their electrical grids. I'm looking at Texas in particular. They're going to have a chance to be able to modernize and try some innovative ways to do it because this grant money is going to be available. Now, one of the criticisms of this legislation in general is that it's mostly carrots and not very many sticks. In terms of offering incentives and punishments. This is one of the big carrots. And I mean, we're going to see how this actually plays out over time. But it seems like the sort of thing that a smart piece of progressive climate legislation ought to do. So that's another big aspect of this legislation that I think progressives can get behind.
Also, you know, I just wanted to name, too, right, when you're talking about carrots, right, and how it seems like there are carrots in here for, you know, corporate interests. There are, but they have benefits for the American people. So, for instance, the Reverend Warnock, senator from Georgia, voted and was supporting and getting out in front for moving forward with the Inflation Reduction Act. And now Hyundai has announced plans to speed up opening a new electric vehicle plant in Georgia that will create, of course, electric vehicles and clean energy jobs for Georgians. Like, I mean, there are wins here that I think sometimes we want the sticks. We want to punish those corporate interests so hard, right?
Yes, we recognize that we
sometimes, unfortunately, punish ourselves, too, at the same time. So I'm for the carrots in this case. And, of course, we've already, you know, kind of talked through the fact that, no, there's no such thing as a completely clean vehicle. There's no such thing as a zero emissions type vehicle because, you know, the emissions that it takes to produce the vehicle are there. However, when we're talking about jobs and getting people employed in, you know, high wage family wage jobs, right? This is what I'm talking about. The benefit to actual humans in being able to raise a family, take care of themselves, own a home, all of that. It's important.
Indeed it is. 503-231-8187, the number to call. Mark, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for an excellent discussion. I agree with Corey. Biden has to be honored and not vilified. Now, I want to emphasize a couple important critical statements. One, that our system is broken and out of control. And Senator Sinema, who vetoed a provision that would have taxed the billionaires in this bill, is an example of how the system has been corrupted. I'd like to emphasize reducing working hours to a three-day week or a four-day week. I think a Marshall Plan for writers would be very valuable. A Professor McChesney emphasized this some years ago, and this would be very sensible. I think both of these ideas would really impact the environment, would lessen the pressure on nature. Gridlock would be reduced. I wonder why there isn't a program of federal affordable apartments in every needy city. Housing should be a matter of security, of domestic security. It's also a matter of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Why are we trivializing? Why can't we see this great distress? You know, the two great failures of neoliberalism were housing and taxation. And I'm saddened as a German translator who can't get anything published that we can't really address the crucial issues. You know, we need economic rethinking. We need to open ourselves to kind of a demand economy instead of a market economy. You know, revive regulation and antitrust regulations and a windfall profits tax. We have to close the tax havens. These are all imperative, and yet they're all taboo. What's your comment on that?
Absolutely. I totally agree with you, Mark, that they dropped the ball on housing in this bill. Of course, I think I shared about what Governor Jay Inslee had done in Washington, where he increased incentives for building, but for green buildings. This is missing from this act, and something that we will continue to demand. Right, we've got houseless people, unsheltered people, in the middle of, you know, 100-plus degree summer. And once again, right, we continue to forget those people because it's inconvenient, right? If you build housing, it has to be affordable housing. And I always say, affordable for whom, right? Who are we talking about? Because right now, the rent costs in all of the cities across America do not allow for a person making a minimum wage to be able to live there. And so, yes, this is something that we have to continue pushing upon. Yeah. We have to continue demanding, and we have to create local solutions as well, because sometimes we expect the Joe Bidens and national solutions for local problems.
Yeah, thank you, Mark, for the call. A very good point. Yeah, you can't. if only we could craft one giant piece of legislation that addresses each of the many needs of our society, economically, socially, educationally, medically, and on and on and on. But we can't, which is not to say these things aren't important. So thank you, Mark, for reminding us that perhaps the next big mountain that progressives need to try and climb is some sort of equitable arrangement in this country so we can actually afford to live here and actually live in the communities where we work. Okay. 503-231-8187. I do, though, want to take issue with one thing Mark said at the very beginning of his call. He said we must honor Biden, not vilify him. I disagree. You don't have to honor the guy. You don't. You don't have to like him. You don't have to honor him. You don't have to vote for him, again, if he runs for president. All I'm saying is give credit where it's due. That's what I'm saying. 503-231-8187. Tracy, I want to quickly touch on something you mentioned just now. You're talking about the incentives in this legislation for the purchase of clean of electric vehicles. Now, it increases the time horizon of electric vehicle rebate that has existed in the past, and it also creates one of a smaller amount for the purchase of used electric vehicles. Now, this is hugely important. We talked about this a few weeks ago on the show. This puts the government's hand offering incentives in the secondary electric vehicle market, which is enormous. So this means an even deeper permeation of electric vehicles into the American populace. But there's a problem with the legislation with regard to electric cars. If your electric vehicle is not entirely assembled in North America, it is not eligible for the incentive. So this freezes out a whole lot of electric vehicles from being touched by this legislation, which is unfortunate. And I think viewed from a certain angle is counterproductive. Now, I understand the motivation here, which was to push towards and incentivize the manufacture and assembly of these vehicles here in the United States to give jobs to Americans, something I'm very much behind. But it seems perhaps a little short-sighted to not make that, to not let consumers cast a wider net in terms of the kinds of vehicles they want to buy with these incentives. What do you think about that, Tracy?
I mean, I think it is a fix, right? The fix is in, because of course those people who are already purchasing, right, who had purchased expecting to get something, will likely be very disappointed, right? That $7,500 is not coming to you because of where your electric vehicle was built. However, right, if you hold off, right, we've got this plants coming. I just, you know, talked about the Hyundai plant in Georgia. Other manufacturers are planning and building towards a fully manufactured in America vehicle that will get you that discount. Of course, right now too, the just like the housing market, the used car market and the car market in general is ridiculously backlogged because of this chips problem and not having enough electric chips to be able to use cars with the new technology. And so the Chips and Science Act should also be addressing that by the production of chips that are also made in America. This made in America equals jobs for Americans. I just can't stress that enough. So yeah. There is, of course, a corporate interest benefit, and there's an interest for actual humans. And, you know, for folks like me who are, you know, looking casually, I'm not in the big rush, but wanting to get away from a gas-run vehicle, I'm just thinking about all my options, but I do want that $7,500.
Kind of makes me wish Elon Musk wasn't such a huge jerk.
Ever. Never.
All right, 503-231-8187. Let's go to Robbie. Good morning.
I'll mention, you know, we're celebrating these electric vehicles, which are still being charged using the same fossil fuels that are polluting the planet. But secondly, what you said with the cars and the manufacturers, that happened first in like the late 80s and the mid 80s, whenever Japanese, many foreign car manufacturers had the market on lockdown. And basically what they did, Reagan passed a law to make manufacturing here, and all they did is start putting plants here. So yeah, those plants will start coming. But the larger problem here is that these corporations are the ones that are slowing down this progress. And it's just amazing because I'm listening to you and it's like, on one hand, you're like, look at this massive mountain. We progressed. We got this, you know, inflation reduction bill, which personally I don't think really does much. And then you go to the other side and you're like, yeah, there's also a lot of short-sightedness. So it's just like, I'm confused listening to you, because it's just like, I hear you apologizing for it, not holding it accountable. And what I see is these corporations that are slowing this progress down when they buy our politicians, which is a part of the Democratic Party. What's happening is we're just going to be funneled into this Amazon, Microsoft, Walmart, you know, LGBT, BLM, and we're going to, you know, like take care of the environment. And it's going to be corporate sponsored, which I don't approve of. I don't think that they actually care. I think they're doing it because there's just finally enough people kind of wanting to hold them accountable, but they're giving us these breadcrumbs. The activists that get stuff done, like a working, like the 5-day work week, those were anarchists. There was no voting involved. It was when we were together with people power, boycotting and doing strikes. And we demanded people didn't show up to work. And now we have a 5-day work week because of anarchists. There was no voting that ever got that done.
Yeah, but I don't understand, Robbie. Well, I have several things to say about that. Let me take what you said at the end there first. Neither Tracy or I are asserting that there is no role in our future for strikes, for direct action, for activism of all sorts. No, there is absolutely a place for those things. And you know, frankly, I think the sooner the better. The sooner the United States can mount a real and lasting general strike, the faster we will move towards achieving the goals that we share as progressives.
Now, can secondly, I tell you why that doesn't happen?
No, hang on. Secondly, you gave almost a textbook rendition of what I'm talking about when progressives reject something because it isn't perfect. We're here telling you today that the effort to mitigate and roll back the effects of industrially caused climate change are much better off today for the passage of this bill than they were 2 weeks ago before the bill was passed. Now, if you as a progressive can't see that, recognize it, and appreciate it, I'm really not sure what to tell you.
Well, let me tell you what I see, right? What I see is that this bill got, you know, had to get revised so everybody could vote for it, which is a part of the reason why I'm not really supportive of it. But secondly, what's going on here is this is that we're taking one step forward and two steps back. And you're like, look at all the progress.
You got that backwards. That's entirely backwards.
Well, maybe that's just because it's my view. But again, all these electrical cars are still charging on fossil fuels. But let me give an example, because what we have is a partial zero emission vehicle, which are all over the streets. Right, these cars, which are adhering to the federal guidelines, which were bought by the same corporations that manufacture these cars, in order for them to be considered partial zero emissions, your car will turn itself off at a red light when you hold the brake for longer than 2 or 3 seconds. That's because the fuel injectors just notice the car not moving, they turn off. You've noticed this, right? This is the type of progress that we're going to see when we're doing this and we're okay with it. I don't think that's okay. They can make cars run a whole bunch better. There is so many more better ways that they can do this. And what they are doing is they are lollygagging and they're making everybody poor so that way we can't make our own businesses. And now we're going to go to Walmart and buy our electric cars. And then we're going to see a little carbon meter and it's going to be like, oh, how much carbon did you save today? Great. And then it's like, then these corporations are going to get carbon taxed and just pay the difference and put it into their profits. That's not good enough. And I think if the progresses, you know, if they actually want progress, they would hold it accountable and they would stop. There would be boycotting. They would be. But here's the problem. We will never go against what the Democrats say, because there's people like you on the airwaves saying, well, we don't like Joe Biden, but we got to vote for him. And then they're going to continue to do the half evil stuff.
I didn't realize. Hey, Robbie, did you hear the part where we talked about phasing out coal-fired power plants in 10 years? Did you hear about that part?
Okay, yeah. I would love to see that. That would be great.
Okay. All right, listen, Robbie, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Thank you. Bye-bye. Tracy, you have anything to say about that?
No, I really don't. I think it's a complete mischaracterization. I am not over here celebrating anything, but saying, once again, right, we've said it, let's not give up the good with expectation for the great. I mean, what Robbie just said, he doesn't even believe in the democratic process of bringing a bill forward, having people give input on that bill to create something that everyone can agree upon and that can pass. I mean, I don't understand what the, you know, political, you know, underpinnings of a Robbie are. But I am not an anarchist, nor will I ever be an anarchist. I am also not a person that, you know,
loves the system that we're in. It is the system that we're in. And I've said multiple times, the alternative is some kind of revolution, which will get me and other people who look like me, black people, killed. So I'm very nervous about folks who are so far to the left that they don't even believe in the actual principles that, of course, we've never lived up to, but are, to me, aspirational. That's just who I am, and I'm okay with it. But I am absolutely not a person who loves the system, loves the corporate interests. I've said several times, when we get power, what we need to do is fundamentally shift the system. We don't have that power yet, so we have to do what we can right now with the time that we have on this earth.
Well, apparently you and I, by virtue of being on the radio, have an enormous amount of power. Who knew?
I don't know.
Well, we are right up against it here. There was more I wanted to dig into about this legislation, but I think I will leave that to your own inquisitive mind. There's plenty of documentation, plenty of research and analysis out there. I encourage you to go look at it. To sum up, this is a good bill. We need more like it. It's not where we need to be, but it's the biggest step we've ever taken toward where we need to be. Tracy, send us home.
What I'll say is it's, you know, getting close to the beginning of the school year. If you haven't touched grass yet, get outside, touch grass, enjoy the rest of the summer. It is cooling down a little bit after the end of this week. It's going to be in the 90s tomorrow and Thursday. Friday, it'll be warm again. So get outside. Enjoy some fresh air. Of course, keep yourself safe. COVID's still out there. Monkeypox is still out there. Wear a mask, social distance. Stay home if you're sick. Take care of yourself and others.
All right. This has been Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7 FM. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week. Early warning, he got